What do I want to ask you? How did you? No, that's. I was gonna say, do you remember when you first heard of Willie Flotten?
Vlotten, right?
Vlotten.
I think it's Willie Vlotten.
All right, I won't use any of this.
Willie Vlotten.
I was so impressed with how much he doesn't appear to have changed, despite all his success. Like when you talk to him, he doesn't come off as a wildly successful writer and musician.
I would agree. That's Reno, fool. That is Reno.
That's all people from Reno are like that?
You can't have that big a head.
Oh.
No, but I would agree because when you think about it, the dude, I mean, the motel life turned into a movie. Lean on Pete turned into a movie. I mean, for a writer, that's a big deal. Like, and it seems like that's kind of almost his MO. Yeah, but Reno, that's Reno, yes, is the answer to your question.
And just if people don't know why you keep bringing that up, both you and Willie grew up in Reno.
Both Willie and I are alums from Reno High School. Go Huskies.
That's right.
Go Huskies. And as you'll find out in the interview, we discussed that and how I think that when you walk down the halls back in the day, although this predates him, that the Baja Men's Who Let the Dogs Out should have been the bell. So once class was over, if the Baja Men's Who Let the Dogs Out, wouldn't that have been awesome if we all went onto the halls with Who Let the Dogs Out? You'll play a snippet of this.
Wait, what does that have to do with Reno High?
Because that has to do with Reno High, because we were Huskies. So the dogs would come out. Right. We would all coalesce walking down the halls to our next classes. It would have been a real team builder. I brought this up in the interview.
That's good. I remember.
He was there before. He's 52. So he was there before the Baja Men smashed 1999 single, Who Let the Dogs Out, came out. But, yeah, he was a cool dude.
It's a good song.
It is a good song. And, I mean, it's something that matters deeply to me. The Baja Men. Their entire catalog I enjoy, but I'll also say that song for me, and tacitly for Willie, means a lot.
I don't know if... Can you name any of their other songs?
No, but that doesn't make a difference.
Oh. Who let the dogs out?
But the motel life, I saw the movie. I'm not going to lie to you. Before I read the book, this is probably like 2013, 2014. So the movie's really good. Filmed, I think, largely in Reno. Book is amazing. And I've had a couple of Reno friends over the years because he's the biggest, you know, in the last 20 years, he's one of the bigger writers to come out of Reno. I mean, Reno isn't, you know, the most literary of towns.
No.
And, you know, the dude's a dual force because also he's a musician. And Richmond Fontaine is a band that I had always heard a lot about. And I years ago, I think on LimeWire. Remember LimeWire?
Yeah.
Is LimeWire still around? I was going to say RIP, but LimeWire might still be around.
I have no idea.
But I downloaded one of Richmond Fontaine's albums, and I liked it, but I think they have like 11 albums. They have a lot of albums. I mean, he's a very prolific dude. Was I going with
and
that?
And now he's performing with the DeLines.
The DeLines, yeah. And so they're on tour right now with their new album, The Imperial.
Are they in Ireland right now?
They played Cork last month, yeah, where I, again, did study abroad at the University of College Cork.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was my salad days.
How long were you in Cork?
I was in Cork for like 8 months.
Huh.
Sowed my oats.
Ew.
Do people say that these days?
Gross.
Sowing your oats is not ew.
I think
I sowed some wild oats is a common... That doesn't have anything... You're acting like there's some innuendo there. That just means you had a good time.
Let's change.
But yeah, they're on tour. This is their second album, The Imperial. It's really good. They are playing an album release show in Portland on the 16th of February.
Yeah, and you said that you'll go with me this time.
this time? Did we miss the last DeLionne?
Well, I went the last time, but you didn't come.
To the album release party of the DeLionne's new album?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool. Then, yeah, this time I will go with
Thank you, Jeff.
No, I mean, they're good. And he's from Reno, and Reno 911 sucks. The television show.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Well, don't.
All right. I think this is my favorite interview so far.
Why?
I don't know. He's just such a good talker. And like, for once, it didn't matter how bad you and I are as hosts, because he's such a good guest.
Yeah, I think I think he's good at making people feel at ease. I mean,
he just had really great stories. Maybe we should stop talking about it and let people hear. Or we
sure.
can keep talking.
No, let's do it.
All right. Willy Flotten.
Vlotten.
Vlotten. That's my Dutch making me say it wrong. Welcome to the steer.
Is that good?
That's good. That's right. Really kind of like...
A good intonation?
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because... Well, whatever. Yeah, let's do this.
How is your... Can you just
Hello.
Talk?
Hello.
Yeah, my headphones aren't working, but I don't know if it matters. No.
They're not working?
But it doesn't really matter, I don't think, unless I'm talking too... I guess the only reason to have it is if I'm talking too loud.
No, but I'll be in charge of that.
Bum. Then that's all right. So, hey, what'd you take in? Did you ever have Gail Marie Palmyre?
I did.
She's a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
I took writing classes from her in 1990. 91?
Yeah. Well, I took writing classes from her in 99, and because I turned 35 this month. So,
yeah. That's cool. She's great, huh?
She was good.
Yeah.
I was too nervous to ask her for a letter of recommendation, but she, yeah, I took quite a, it's probably like 3 classes from her.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Guy, you missed it. There was a really cool guy. Well, we can keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me if those work now.
All right.
Do you hear?
Check. Yeah, that works great, man.
Yeah, okay.
But Gail Marie Palmyre, is that how you say your last
name? Palmyre?
Palmyre, yeah. She was someone, because I didn't really have much of a focus, and then I did take a creative writing class from her at UNR, and she was kind of instrumental, and then I was too bashful to, I had a poetry collection come out in 2014, and I sent it to her, but... Yeah, I mean, she was. I should have been more like kind of open about it, but she was really important for me as a writer. I mean, growing up, like still to this day.
She'd love to hear that, I bet.
Well, I sent her this book, and I did write a little like kind of heartfelt note, and I never heard anything.
Well, she's not the best at responding.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So don't take it personally.
So you, because you know her better than me, I guess.
Well, I keep in touch with her.
Oh, you
like,
do. Oh,
yeah,
you do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll go hang out with her when I'm in town. But she's not the best at like getting back to you. So don't take it personally.
Well, no, I didn't take it personally. So you were at UNR when?
On and off from 90 to or 88 to 91, 92, something like that.
And did you end up graduating, or did you?
Yeah, I ended up graduating from U of O.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I took about half the classes at UNR.
So, and you did? Was there another? I'm trying.
Oh, there's
to
think, a
UNR
there's a,
English there, professor. There, she was the one that was most important to you.
There was a guy named Randall Reed who died. You would have loved him, man. He was like a
Randall. Yeah, I don't.
He was like a. I started dressing like him. Like I used to wear like shaft coats and the cowboy shirts.
Oh, really?
It was all because of him. And I used to grease back my hair like him.
Great.
Until I was dating this gal, and she's like, "I'm gonna break up with you. I'm gonna break up with you if you keep fucking greasing your hair."
In his class, like, I mean,
no, I'd never do it in his class.
But so
outside his class, because I loved him so, because I'd never met a real writer. This is like before the internet. So
oh no, totally.
So I didn't know anybody. So I dressed like him. I tried to do everything like a man. And I didn't even, because I just heard he'd written a novel. And I couldn't even find the novel he'd written. But he was super cool guy, real Western kind of guy. Loved all the kind of down and out.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I was messing with the faders. Who are you talking about?
Randall Reed.
Randall Reed,
yeah,
okay.
Just a professor, you know. But he died. He passed away, I don't know, 92, 91, 92.
Okay. Do you know any of the Urzas?
Gabe Burza? Okay. Because that's how, when Motel Life came out, that's how, did Motel Life come out in 2014?
No, it came out 2006.
2006, and maybe the movie came out.
Oh, yeah, maybe 2012, I think.
Movie, okay, yeah. That's how, I guess, I first kind of, Gabe Burza teaches at Portland State now, and I always forget it, but his family, his mom is originally a Laxalt.
Okay.
And so, I don't know all the breakdown, but he teaches at Portland State, and he's the one who introduced me to your work. I guess when that came out, so maybe it was like 11 years ago now, if that came out in 06.
Yeah, Laxalt, Robert Laxalt was a...
Well, right, and I've never read anything by
Robert. Oh, shit, dude, you love him, man.
Oh, really? See, oh, yeah. I don't...
And it's cool stuff.
It's nature-y.
No, man. It's got some of that, but his most famous... I wish I would have known, because I collect his books.
Really?
I would have given you a copy. There's one, Sweet Promised Land.
Okay.
It's about an old sheep, bass sheep herder in Carson City, and his son taking him back to the bass country before he dies.
So visit. They're Basque, yeah. My friends.
Hardcore. Yeah, Laxalt and... his stuff's great, man. Okay. I mean, it's real old school Nevada.
Right, but he's one of the most famous Nevada. I mean, that family. Totally. I mean, he's one of the most famous.
Yeah, his brother was a senator.
Right.
And then I guess one of their relatives ran for, I think, governor? Or...
Just recently.
Did he lose?
Lost. He was a Republican. Yeah, he lost.
Yeah, his family came out against him. And
oh, really?
I read some funky stuff about him just about because I was researching the... oh, shit, we should probably... record this, huh?
Well, I am recording.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're on. We're doing. Okay. We're
yeah. Good. I don't know if I'll use any of it. But.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll keep it together now. All right. Well, I'll tell you about that stuff later.
Oh, if you don't want me to use anything you said,
doesn't matter.
Okay.
But it probably wouldn't matter to anyone. Probably.
Sure.
Talking about.
Well, this is the latest Laxalt, and his family came up against him, and this is public knowledge, right? The one that just ran for. Senator or something. I didn't know that his family came out against.
Yeah, some of them did. They came out with a statement saying that he's not he wasn't raised in Nevada. He's not a real Nevadan.
Oh, that's interesting.
He's wearing it like a suit, you know, kind of thing. I read some interesting stuff about him when I was studying and researching the book. Don't skip out on me. Parts of the sheep herding stuff was in tribute to Robert Laxalt, the writer. Mm. I was wanting to pay tribute to certain writers in that book, and he was a part of that. So I was reading a lot about sheep herding and
in the Basque Country.
Well, it was what happened like in the late 1800s or so. A lot of Basque immigrants became sheep herders in Western United States, and that's how the Bass restaurant started. When the sheep herders would get off the mountain, they wouldn't have anywhere to go, so the people, the Bass community in the city, would have rooming houses, and then they'd have one meal a day.
Go to Louis.
Exactly, it was like Louis, and like that's why Louis had upstairs for years and years had apartments for rent, rooms for rent.
Okay,
Santa Fe did as well. And then, it's gone on to now it's like more like Peruvian, Central American, sheep herders in Western United States. And the Bass is it's just a history mark. It's, the only remnants are the Basque restaurants now.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I knew the Laxalt name and I'm friends like Gabe Burza, his mom is one of the Laxalts, but I've never read anything by Robert Laxalt.
He's
and
a really,
I should.
Well, I'd say if you like that old school kind of Nevada stuff, it's interesting.
I mean,
and my mom was real. She loved Basque, everything Basque. So I grew up going to all the Bass restaurants in like Gardnerville and Minden and that's what we'd go out to Elko and Winnemucca just to eat at Bass joints.
Because you're born and raised in Reno.
Yeah. I lived in Reno till I was 27.
Okay. And then, well, we talked about this before, but where in Reno did you grow up? Like, you moved around a little bit.
Well, my mom lived off Hunter Lake, and then I lived, that's where I grew up. And then as an adult, I just lived in little apartments around town.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved it, you know. Reno, I was kind of born to the right city. There's a certain segment of Reno that I always identified with, and it was the kind of drifter, kind of beat up men that kind of infiltrated all the motels around Reno. I just always thought I'd end up there. Mm-hmm. I had a big edge on me, and so it made sense to me seeing those kind of guys that didn't seem they weren't quite homeless. They weren't quite. You weren't sure if they were drug addicts. They were just wild and kind of driftery and kind of bums.
Mm-hmm.
And I just assumed I would be one. And
you assumed you would be one.
I assumed from about 16, I assumed I would probably be a bum. And so I started hanging out in like more divey Reno bars. I got a fake ID and I used to hang out in those kind of places just
Shays?
To see.
Corrigan's?
Worse than that. Like,
oh, okay.
Yeah, like... The Last Dollar Saloon was a place I used to hang out with, which is now across from Louis.
Okay, then that, yeah. Like, I don't think it's that anymore, though. Do you
no,
think?
No. Yeah. So more down and out uh-huh. kind of places. When I was with my friends, I would drink at Corrigan's and those kind of places, sure. The Zephyr and all that. But when there was a bar called Mr. O's.
Oh, well, Mr. O's, and that's had a lot of, now it's called...
The Chapel.
Now it's called, I think, 40 Mile Club.
You're right.
They've changed it again. Yeah. But it's still a bar and it's still there.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I was just back 3 weeks ago and we walked right by it. Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up drinking in that bar. I don't know. So there was a certain aspect of that city that I really identified with. And not in the most positive way, but it felt real normal mm-hmm. to me. So I liked it. So that's what I had to leave. Because I was a failed musician in Reno, my mother was pretty right wing and was not she wasn't a fan of the arts. So being a failed musician in a town where your mom is down the street, you know, and knows you're a bum anyway. So I moved to Portland because bands from Portland started coming through Reno, and I started seeing them and talking to them after the gigs and. And they said, you should move up. It's a great place. So I don't know, it was like 93.
When you moved up here?
Yeah.
Okay. And then your mom wasn't a big fan of the arts. What was your family life growing up? Was your father?
I lived with my mom and my brother. Okay. And then later on, my mom had a boyfriend that moved in when I was, I don't know, 12.
Okay.
I never lived with my dad. My mom was cool. She just was not a fan of, you know, me being in a band and me writing stories. But, you know, she was all right.
Where did, if I'm just curious where growing up there and just talking about the whole environment you were living in, I'm wondering where you got the influence to start writing music and stories. Like, who was
I mean,
you that?
Really, escapism.
Yeah.
My brother had a friend in high school and, my brother was wrote songs and he was a huge music fan from a kid, and I was too. We both loved records, and my brother had a friend when I was like 12. He took me aside and he just said, "Look, man, anytime you're depressed," because I was a shy little, I was really shy, and I was kind of a sad sack kid. And he goes, "Man, just disappear into a song."
Wow.
And so
your brother's friend said this.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it really stuck with me, so I just started living inside like Yes songs and Rush and you know, Bruce Springsteen and those kind of guys. I would just live inside their songs all day long. I wouldn't go anywhere without like a cassette tape in my pocket in case I could. You know, it was like my best friends. Yeah. And so then when I started writing songs, I wanted to write, you know, like songs were difficult for me early on. To write any decent ones, it took me years and years and years, but I could disappear into whatever world I wanted. Same with stories, you know. I started writing stories around 18, and it was strictly just to disappear from where I lived and where I was and who I was. So I just I did it for pure escapism.
I wonder if that guy, your brother's friend, has any idea how much that meant to you.
I told him, he recently passed away from alcoholism, all things, and I told him, I don't know, you know, it really, you know, it was a pretty cool thing to say, to a kid, especially sad sack kid, and my brother also told me, he just said, anytime you're feeling down, you should just write a song about it, And that was around 12 or 13, so I did.
Who taught you to play guitar?
I just kind of picked it up. My brother played. Mm-hmm.
Is your brother older or younger?
Older.
Oh, okay. So he that played can be important, yeah.
Yeah. I worshipped him, and he played folk, you know. My taste is a little darker than his.
How much older is he?
4 years.
4 years, okay.
And he was kind of the hero of our family, so everybody loved him, and still does. And so, I did everything he did. You know, I played sports. I played the same sports he played. I played guitar because he played guitar. Mm-hmm. I just had a darker edge, and I bought into rock and roll. I really bought into it. I was a real vulnerable kid, I think, and I really believed in it all. You know, I believed, you know, by the time I was 16, 17, the Replacements were, I really believed in those guys and like that they had the answer to my life. And their answer was like, you know, drink and destroy. Mm-hmm. And that kind of destructive side of rock and roll, I always identified with, I guess. Mm-hmm.
But you don't necessarily, I mean, I don't think of Richmond Fontaine or the, I mean, it's not like Replacements. It's got the overtones of the Replacements, but I don't think destroy, I guess, when I listen to your music. I mean,
I guess just that kind of self-destructive nature, mm-hmm, of the Replacements. I always battled with that.
Sure.
But I also I came from a real hardworking, my mom was really hardworking. Like she was one of those people that said, like, if you're sick, you can not go to school, but if you're sick, you go to your job. And you're supposed to hate your job, but you got to work twice as hard,
right,
as anybody else, or you're going to get fired and end up sleeping by the river. She was, like, pretty hardcore about stuff like that. So it really ingrained in me. So most of my life I battled between, like, wanting to disappear into old man bars and give up and then a work ethic. So those have been – so, yeah, I always gravitated towards bands like the Replacements, but then I'd always get up in the morning and go to work.
Well, because you are industrious. I mean,
yeah.
You have, was it 5 novels in a decade?
Around 12, 13 years. I'm a hard worker.
And music, too. I mean, those are two, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those two always battle with me.
Where did you go to high school in Reno?
Reno High.
Oh, so did I. Huskies.
All right. Yeah,
there
yeah.
we go.
Yeah.
This is amazing. So you're growing up, but you're there until 27. And I mean, are the bands that you're playing in, are they, what names? I mean, I guess, or like.
There was, I guess the main one was me and just one other guy called Gray Mauser. Okay. And it was, no one liked us. I guess the claim to fame I have is we opened, there was a band called the Boston Wranglers. And the Boston Wranglers were like, kind of like a cow punky version of the Birds.
Okay.
And they were kind of like Richmond Fontaine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really influenced by them. I really loved them. I used to sneak into their shows in high school. I worshipped them, and we got to open up for them, and those guys were really nice to us.
Oh, that's important, too.
Yeah, it was really nice. But, you know, I just, you know, I wasn't that good either. I could
good
never...
Good at playing or good at just...
Any of it.
Okay.
You know, I bought into it. I was really shy. I couldn't play sober until I was maybe 30.
That's what I was going to ask for a shy kid, how the heck you got on stage, but probably
it
alcohol.
It was pretty rough, you know. I just loved rock and roll so much, and I thought, you know, I always wanted to be in a band that had a van and had a flyers and like a real band. Like I used to see, like, now I see a band van and I get like, all like, oh, God, those poor, you know, like sitting in a van all the time. But when I was a kid, it was like seeing a band's beat up van that had out of state plates. I thought, Jesus, they're a real band.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's free,
so, it was hard. It was really hard. I just drank a lot and it was like terrifying and it was awful. It was really awful. I don't know why I did it. But if I didn't do it, I'd probably just be working in a warehouse right now and unable to barely order a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
It cured me of being shy.
Yeah.
But I had to drink. I drank till I was so drunk I could barely stand.
Mm.
And then eventually when I moved up here, I was just the same. And then we were playing this place called the Paris Theater. And, this guy drove all the way from, like, Chico, California, to see us. And he had to drive. He was sleeping in his car that night. Hmm. And then he had to drive back and try to go to his job.
Hmm.
And I was really drunk, and I played really bad. And I felt I felt so ashamed that this guy had driven all the way to see us, and I'd done that to him. That I got my act together after that, and you know, I kind of cured myself out of it, just out of guilt of this poor guy sacrificing his money and time and sleeping in his car to see us, and I was a bum on it. So,
wow. Do you still drink?
Not right now, I'm not, but because I'm writing a book, and the older I get, the dumber I'm getting, I think. So I'm trying to figure out ways to be smarter, and that's one. But yeah, man, I like it. It's always been a crutch, and it's like, this is a really silly thing to say, but Shane McGowan, who was mm-hmm. one of
the
my
Pogues.
One of my high school heroes. He's another guy that's a bad guy to have as a hero, but he always said, man, I see angels when I'm drinking, and I always did too. It's always been easy for me to just disappear. I have a few drinks and I'm off in my fantasy land. But you know, as you get older, it starts asking more of you. Mm-hmm. And so right now I'm working on this book, and I'm not smart enough to do it without like ratcheting it down on myself and trying to, you know, live like a monk for a while.
So when you're working more on a book than music, do you completely change your lifestyle?
Yes.
Oh, really?
In what ways?
Well, when I'm writing, so it's all about endurance, mm-hmm. and being clear-headed, and so yeah, I don't go out much, I don't drink much, I try to go running and stuff that. Yeah,
you're in Scott Poos now, right?
Yeah, man.
And how big is that? How big is Scott Poos? Is that
it's
even
like 5,000?
Oh, so it's smallish.
Maybe it's 8,000. I don't know. I live 5 miles outside it.
Okay.
I live in the coast kind of range. It's beautiful, like right on the edge of a lot of logging areas. So yeah, it's beautiful.
So there's opportunity to isolate yourself. I mean, it's not like you're in.
I've always been good at that. You know, like we were saying earlier, like I always lived by myself from even when I was like, you know, 20, 21, I lived by myself just because so I wouldn't go out and mm-hmm. so I wouldn't be influenced by a roommate who came back with a 12-pack and a movie, you know. So I was always trying to write my stories and write my tunes, I'm just following that kind of way of thinking even now. Mm-hmm. It shifts a little bit, but the only way to write is you got to work hard at it, and it takes a long time. I'm not that good at it, and I'm not that smart, so I have to. The only thing I have to offer is perseverance, you know. So when you see me and I look halfway healthy, you know, man, he must be writing a book. And then I always say when I look like I've slept under a car, you're like, I bet he's writing songs now. Because songs I always write when my life goes sideways.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you got to do something when your life goes sideways.
Yeah, well, it's good that you, it sounds like you actually have a pretty good balance. You know how you're feeling, which to, and when to do what.
It's not that clear cut, you know, but I guess the only common thing on them is I really do love writing stories. It's always been one of my favorite things to do, and I've always loved being in a band. And so I always try to serve those two, to keep those in my life. Mm-hmm. And I've been fairly diligent about that, I guess, to keep it both those going in my life.
Well, you have that ingrained work ethic too. You treat, there's some people love things and then that's where they leave them. It seems like you love things, but you also treat them like a job. I mean, you treat them like a professional thing because you are kind of a professional in two different realms, right?
I mean,
you don't work on inspiration, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Like, I mean, love
you hustle, you work like.
Yeah, you know, I always just loved it so much. I knew I wasn't very good at it. Talking first, I guess, songs. I don't know why I kept going, because I didn't have much talent and I didn't like being in front of people. I still don't really, but I just really wanted to be in a band, and the camaraderie of a band, like the camaraderie of Rich and Fontaine, was like, it's like heaven. Mm-hmm. Even after 23 years, I miss those guys.
Because they're all over, right? Where do all the members live?
They all live here.
Oh, they
and
live
two,
in?
Two of the guys are in the DeLines.
Okay.
One of my favorite guys, I just saw him play last night, Dan Eccles. He lives in town too. And I wish we needed another guitar player in the DeLines, but we just don't. It's a different kind of band. But I've always liked being in a band. I've never felt very confident about it. With writing, it's just, I just like it. I really like writing stories. And so it never feels like I'm sacrificing. It always feels lucky, like when everybody's working, busting it every day, and I get to write stories. I feel really lucky, and I, you know, it's like you're given a chance. I don't want to blow it, you know.
Yeah. How do you feel about reading in public?
I'm okay with all that stuff now. Yeah. You know, I humiliated myself so many years in Reno. You know, like I got the plug pulled on me a bunch of times. I had
for readings.
No, for for gigging.
Oh yeah,
gigging,
yeah,
okay. And then I used to play this kind of folk gig, and I had, you know, you just get humiliated enough that they after a while you either quit or you just get over it. And with writing, I always figured doing reading, if you're helping your pals, you're helping your book, and I like my books, whether they're good or not, I don't know, but I like them. Mm-hmm. They're my friends, and so you always want to do right by them. And so I don't mind them. I don't mind reading. And I like being around people that like books. It's hard to meet people that really like books. And so hanging out in bookstores, you get that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're in Reno until you're 27 in bands. And then you started writing, though. I mean, I think I read somewhere that you wrote 4 novels between 18 and 35 or something.
Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, so
that's a lot. And
yeah, because I was at that time I was working, you know, I was always working full time, and I had a band that was playing a lot.
Is that Richmond? When did they?
Richmond started when I was 28, 27, 28.
Okay, so right after when you moved.
Yeah, I moved up here and got that band going right away. Yeah, so you know, I was always writing, trying to. Like if my life had hit a ditch here and there, I'd quit writing. But in general, yeah, I just worked. I worked and was in my band. And then in the morning before I got up, before I left for work, I would write. So like 5:30 or whatever, I would drink energy drinks and try to crank out a couple pages. And, you know, it worked sometimes. And
But you didn't show a lot of that stuff to other people. I mean, so would you write something and you'd be like, this is no good, but I feel I'm going to do another one? I mean,
yeah, I just like doing it.
So it was just like a pure enjoyment thing.
I mean, yes.
That's interesting.
Still feel that way. Battle with myself for years. I battled to show anybody because you don't want to show. If you write a novel and people say, man, you're no good, then will you get up before work and try? I don't know. If somebody says you're really not talented, I didn't want to know if I was talented or not because I just enjoyed writing. So being in a band that, you know, people let you know right away.
Right. So that's interesting because the audience is into it or they're not, and you can kind of tell. Whereas with writing, so much different. I mean,
yeah, you can spend years. And I didn't want anyone to tell me my writing was bad. So that's between maybe 20 and 33 or something. I didn't show anybody any of my stuff. Maybe a drinking buddy or something, I'd show him a story I would think he would think is funny or whatever, but I never did much showing it around, purely because I didn't want anybody to say it was bad, and then I wouldn't get up before work and get the enjoyment out of it.
You know? Yeah, you don't want them to take that away from you.
Yeah, because it's hard to try hard at something when people say you're no good at it.
Yeah.
When there's a window where you... Like with being in a band, like everybody said I was no good for years, but I just kept doing it because I figured, you're young and you'll figure it out. With writing, I was a little more jaded because I'd already been beaten up by music. So I wasn't about to show anybody my stories at a certain point. And I just wrote them. Yeah, so I wrote, you know, 3 or 4 novels, 5 novels. I forget what. You know, I wrote, like, Harlequin romance novels. I wrote crazy stuff and serious stuff. I just was having fun.
But when you were at UNR taking classes from, like, Gail Marie Palmyre and stuff, did you get bad criticism? I mean, what?
No.
People, did they like your stuff? Because you did take writing workshops and stuff at UNR, right?
Yeah.
You did have some of these kind of... fundamentals, I guess. I mean, did you? What was the criticism like then?
She was really nice to me.
She was kind of positive. Yeah.
Yes, Gail Marie Palmyre was a writing teacher that there was 2 writing teachers up at UNR. That one of them was a guy named Randall Reed, and he was an old guy by then, but he dressed, like I told you earlier, I loved the guy so much, I started dressing like him when I wasn't in class. He wore like Shaft leather coats and then cowboy shirts, and he greased his hair, and I dressed, and he wore like black postman shoes. And I wore that stuff up. Well, I still do, except for I don't wear the Shaft coat anymore, but I dressed like him for years. Not when I was in class, but I liked.
He was like a legit writer.
He was a legit writer. I never met a legit writer. This is pre-internet, so you just I just didn't meet him, and he looked cool, and I wanted to be like him. And then Gail Marie was just, she was really nice. I think she told me once she read her stories to her boyfriend, her husband at the time. You know, while they're in bed, she'd read all my stories.
Oh,
and
so
I'd
that's
be
flattering
like,
when you're young. I mean, that's a big deal. Like,
yeah, so I started like cranking. I started writing for, I forget who it was. It was her boyfriend or her husband. And I started writing for him because she'd go, oh, he likes that one character. So I started like every week. I drove her nuts because I think I was giving her a story a week for her husband. You know, so right. Yeah, man, I was.
So you had positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
But still, when you were like 29 here, you still weren't ready. I guess I'm just interested because it seems like we live in a day and age when you write a novel and then you want to get an agent and then you like, you know, you do all these things when you're younger, it seems like. Like, it's rare, and maybe I'm wrong, but it's rare if somebody writes something and it's like, well, that's not good enough. Because, I mean, now sometimes maybe you put it on social media. You do something like, you were very insular with this love because you didn't want it tainted by, I guess, people being like, it's bad or, you know, just forgetting about. I mean, because your first novel, when it was published, was a big success. I mean, not a lot of things get turned into movie. You know, like, I mean, it was a big deal. Like,
I mean, I think... you got to take your confidence level. I've always been protective of my confidence level because confidence has always been something that I've struggled with. And so it was a bad gamble for me for years to beat up my books because I didn't – it was so much fun writing them.
Yeah.
And a band gets beat up, and I felt really responsible. If Richmond Fontaine wasn't doing good, it's my fault because I was singing them and I was writing them. Mm-hmm. The band was – they're obviously really good musicians. So if no one likes us, that's my fault. So I felt really, really weighed down by that and guilty, for when we weren't doing good.
Were you a full-time musician? I mean, once you guys got together, were you working other jobs up until?
I always worked jobs until I was 30, until I published Motel Life. Okay. I was a house painter. I had a little house painting business by then.
Okay.
And,
but you're gigging a lot too.
We're gigging and we were touring.
Yeah.
We were touring. But we never made enough money to all quit jobs. But yeah, I felt really responsible for that band. Like, I was really ashamed of myself because I couldn't stop writing these really dark tunes. And then, you know, around 2004, we got offers. One of our records kind of did well in Europe. Surprisingly, out of the blue, none of us even. Well, one guy had a passport, but the other guys didn't even have passports. I'd never been anywhere, really. And we started touring over in Europe. And then I finally felt like, man, at least I got these guys to Europe. At least, we weren't failures, you know.
Right.
And so then I started feeling better. And that's when I started showing my books because I started feeling better.
So the two work off one another, though, at least in that case.
Yeah, yeah. Now the only reason anyone paid attention to my books at that time was because my band was on the upswing.
Right.
And I had more confidence because, we played in England, we played in Ireland and Germany and all these places and Norway. And I was like, well, we must not be that bad. And then you're like, well, all right, I got enough confidence. My confidence is at least in a stable situation. I'd just written that book, The Motel Life, and I had a friend, a guy I'd met, do the illustrations. And so I had that one, and I said, well, maybe they'll publish it because it has pictures. And the guy said, obviously, a good illustrator. And they did. They bought it. And then it was really, really fun. Fun ride.
What was it like? Because now you recently had a second book made into a movie. I'm curious what that's like. Do they involve you at all in the? I'm forgetting the word. It starts with the T.
The treatment.
Where you? It's not like it's sort of like translate. Where you take a book and turn it into a movie.
The adaptation.
Adaptation. Yeah.
You know, I don't really have a ton of interest in writing screenplays. Yeah. I wrote a screenplay once for kind of a hot shot guy, and he paid me really well, and I gave it to him, and then I never heard back from him. And then I ran into him, and I said, "You must have hated my screenplay." And he said, "You never sent it to me."
What?
And I said, "Really?" And I go, "Well, I'll send it to you tonight." And I knew he was just messing with me.
This is somebody who asked for a screenplay from you.
He paid me what I thought was pretty good.
Is this recently? Like in the last?
No, man. This was pretty early on. This is after the Motel Life, and so I sent it to him that night, and I never heard from him again.
That's interesting.
It's weird. I just said, man, I could spend my whole life writing screenplays and getting paid for it. Or not, but maybe getting paid for it, and then nothing ever comes of it.
Right.
So I was like, "Well, why do that?" And plus, again, once you get involved in that world, you have to start arguing about some story already.
Right. It's not yours.
It's not yours. And there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of smart people, and a lot of missing. There's a lot of pieces that have to go in place for a movie to make, and so make it to production. And I never thought I was quite savvy enough to navigate that, or had the stomach for it. So I would just, like with the Motel Life, I just tried to get those guys to say they'd make it in Reno.
Well, right. That's what I was going to say. I mean, a lot of it was in Reno.
Yeah, they did that. They did that.
That was a big thing for somebody who wasn't living in Reno at the time. But I was like, oh, look, like all these spots that I know, like that was.
Yeah, and a lot of those spots like are going to go away.
Already are gone.
Yeah. So I was grateful for that, but. But that's a tricky world. The Motel Life was okay, but the Lean on Pete, Andrew Haig, the director, really cool guy. He's a really smart, really generous guy, and I learned a lot from him, and I really liked him. So that was just a pure pleasure.
Were you on set at all?
Yeah, you know, I'd hang out a little bit. I wouldn't want to, you know, they're all working really hard, and I would just kind of
hanging out.
But there's certain things I wanted to see. Like I like the horse racing parts I wanted to see. There's certain scenes I'd want to see. And just to enjoy it. And it was nice. And they tried, you know, those guys tried really hard.
Yeah.
So it was fun. And then at a certain level, you just gotta leave.
Yeah, I imagine there's a certain amount where you just have to kind of let go, because no matter what, they have to, if not change things, they have to leave things out of the book. And you have to let go of that process.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, it's just that you can't have it both ways. Yeah. You either got to get in bed with them. If they want to get in bed with you, that's a whole other thing. But if you either have to jump in head first and be a part of it, or you know, it's like anything else. You can't sit on the sidelines and criticize.
Right.
I remember with the Motel Life, I didn't like the Chris Christopherson.
Oh,
was
really?
Talking, and I go, "Oh man, this one part." I go, "That one, they messed it up. They didn't understand."
Oh, no.
And then that's when I was like, "Man, you," and I almost wanted to say something, and I said, "Well, Jesus, Chris Christopherson, just lighten up, man." And the things that bother me are the things that I find important in general. Most people don't. So, like the way what the kid was wearing, some certain aspects of the horse racing stuff would really got under my skin, and no, you know, there are problems that no one cared about. So, you know, what do I know really?
Well, it's tough because no matter how much you describe in the writing, there's going to be even more that you see that other people will see differently.
Yeah. And there's things that I think are really important. I mean, I go down my own bad roads with stuff. Like, so I wouldn't necessarily think I have normal tastes. So,
but you did create the thing that are. I mean, you do have some sense of ownership. That's why it's understandable that way.
Yeah. Like, yeah, my take is always probably tends towards the darker side. And once you get involved in that kind of situation, they're trying to get the movie made. And they're juggling money, and they're juggling getting scripts that pass so they can get the money. So they have to lighten up on certain things that I might not have lightened up on. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I don't trust myself on that level, so I just stay out. And, I mean, it's really fun.
Yeah.
And movie people, everybody that works on movies, they like books and music and movies. They like all three. So mm-hmm. you're surrounded by people all day long that are reading books and listen to cool tunes and have good movie tips. So it's not a bad way to spend a couple days.
Yeah.
And you're kind of involved with the music on some of those, right? Or you like?
They were just nice to me.
They were.
They were just nice, and they put in a Fontaine song both in Motel Life and in Lean on Pete.
So but they that didn't was put a Willie like, Nelson song.
No,
Willie Nelson's one of my, so that was the other thing I want. Willie Nelson's one of my favorites. And then
I guess the brothers that made that movie, and I could be wrong about this, but I heard they were arguing over which Willie Nelson song, so they cut Willie out, which I thought was just insanity.
Right.
He's
in that
because he's the patron saint. Yeah. So as a kid, the reason I like Willie so much is he was the first concert I saw.
Oh, really? So I saw him a lot around Reno. Did you see him in?
Yeah, I saw him with Crystal Gayle and Mackie. It was like a daytime Mackie on the football.
Oh, so that was okay. So I was saw him at Casinos. It was at Mackie.
Yeah, it was probably seven.
Okay,
he was pretty
so you
big.
Were younger. Yeah,
I was really young, but my mom was conservative, and we only had maybe seven records in our house,
mm-hmm.
and you know, like a couple Neil Diamond, Pavarotti. Some, you know, like Carpenters, John Denver, and then we had Willie Nelson's Greatest Hits and some that will be. Uh-huh. And the thing about Willie was he was a long-haired hippie, but my mom liked him.
Oh, yeah.
And so he got away with anything. Like, you know, if I had long hair or you liked, was it more of a hippie-leaning man, it wouldn't have flown in my house. But Willie could get away with it.
Right.
So I was like, God, this guy is more punk rock than anybody. Mm-hmm. And everybody likes him. He can get away. My mom loves Willie Nelson. She would get drunk and talk about how he was cute for a dirty hippie, you know? And I was like, Jesus, this guy's my man. So he's always been from that. I've always had that record with me wherever I go.
Right.
Greatest Hits and some that will be. And he's always been my hero and a savior of mine. Because
you opened for him too, right?
Yeah, Fontaine. We opened for him, and
when was that? Was like 20
couple years ago. 15.
Do you meet him?
No, but I got to. I ate tacos with Mickey Raphael.
And, okay, so yeah.
And I remember seeing him once in Reno, and I ate in the same place, a Mexican joint in Reno with Jody Payne, the guitar player who's now passed away. And I met Bobby, and I.
He plays Bobby Nelson. He plays piano. Mickey Raphael plays harmonica.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So I've met a lot of his band, which is it just makes me happy as hell just thinking about it. But he's always been important to me. And so those brothers, I wanted them to have – I always like to give my characters gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And the saint of that – and I always believe in saints of books. And the saint of the Motel Life is Willie Nelson. Because he's a survivor, because he's his own guy,
mm-hmm.
And he's got so much love in his songs, and those brothers needed it.
And he's also industrious with a work ethic.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's
how
a
many
hard-working
albums
guy.
Does Willie Nelson have?
He's a hardworking guy.
Did he just turn 80?
No, man, I think he's in his mid-80s.
Is he that old?
I think so.
Oh, yeah. Is he 82 or something? Oh, is he that?
And his sister's 2 years older than him, too.
Oh, really?
He calls her little sister, but I think she's his older sister.
Yeah, because I always thought that he says on Willie Nelson,
this is my little sister. Yeah, Bobby.
I didn't realize. Well, because he still tours, and obviously, you know,
He's, you know, I've seen him more than anybody. I think I've seen him 40 times.
Well, I haven't seen, I was going to say, I've seen him 8 times. I haven't seen him 40. I got his bandana.
Yeah, I got all that stuff.
Well, he threw it. He threw it
out
in the audience, and I felt kind of like a hoser for grabbing it.
No, you should have grabbed it.
I did.
Damn, I'm going to steal it out of your house, man.
It's blue. I have it. So now, I guess one of the things, who were the songwriters that you kind of found inspiration from when you were younger? And, I mean, was somebody like, because, you know, how did you start writing songs, I guess?
I was really influenced. I mean, what I really loved early on, like 11, 12, was The Who, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. But I couldn't write that stuff very well. And then Springsteen.
Okay.
My brother had all the early Springsteen records. I started trying to write like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then around 81, so I guess I was maybe 14, there was a band. My brother moved to Los Angeles, and he started sending me back records like Rank and File, which is cowpunk.
Mm-hmm.
Long Riders, X, the Blasters, Los Lobos, this whole
okay.
kind of roots rock scene. Green on Red was another band that was big for me. And they were all kind of like, they played country music, but they were punk rockers.
Mm-hmm.
Roots rock, Americana, all country, I guess, is what it's called now. And I bought in. That was where it kind of just bridged the gap. I could, it was story songs, like folk songs, but kind of edgy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was stuff like that. Really influenced me as a kid. Tom Waits was always a big, by the time I was like 20, Tom Waits kind of became my guy, songwriting wise. He was like the kind of songwriter I wished I could be.
Because what did you find in Tom Waits, I guess?
He created worlds.
He created worlds. Okay.
And he was a classic songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could write, I mean, he's like Irving Berlin. I mean, he can write anything.
Right.
And he's funny, and I could never be funny like him. And he was really, he could get really crazy, but he also could be really sentimental
mm-hmm.
and
oh,
romantic.
That's interesting. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've always been leaned towards romanticism, even though my songs don't really reflect it that much. I've always loved songwriters like Shane McGowan that create yeah. like romantic worlds, especially like when you're a kid and or you're working in a warehouse somewhere and you're nothing's going your way. And then you can listen to A Rainy Night in Soho by the Pogues.
Mm-hmm.
And having never been out of the country, having barely been out of Nevada or Oregon. And then all of a sudden you're walking with some gal and you're with the Pogues.
Right.
And I love that. And Tom Waits could do that. You know, Jonesburg, Illinois. You know, mm-hmm. he shore leave about a sailor being on shore leave playing pool with a midget and
right.
Drinking a Singapore sling. I mean, just the escapism of it, the romantic escapism,
sure.
and Springsteen as well was a big influence because he was a romantic in it, but he was also really insecure. He was like he was kind of cocky, but then he had like a knife in him
right.
at the same
huh.
time, and so he was kind of my guy too. I was never as good a songwriter as those guys, but that was the I liked. Those kind of worlds they were creating, working class world.
Mm-hmm.
I always wanted to write working class stories from an early age. I always bought into that, like the working class stories and working class novels were always what I wanted to be a part of.
Because that's what you yourself sprang from, and you
yeah.
wanted to kind of be a part of that.
Yeah. And I understood, you know, my mom, she raised two sons, was always really worried about money, was sexually harassed, all you know,
mm-hmm.
back before they even really had terms of it. Men
right.
were just men. She was kind of beat up by that for 25 years of never took vacations. I mean, we never went mm-hmm. anywhere, you know. She would take like a day and then the weekend
mm-hmm.
or two, you know, Friday and a Monday. So I was always, I knew how hard her life was, and I saw how easy it is for working class people to get beat up, and I at an early age I read Steinbeck, and
right.
he really, like I've read him at a really vulnerable age, and he just kind of stuck those ideas of rich versus poor, and I had a big chip on my shoulder that way.
This is like high school? Or this
yeah,
like...
I always had a really big chip because my dad had money, my mom didn't.
Divide there. That...
Yeah, and it was pretty. It was a pretty big divide, and I day didn't go by where you didn't hear about that.
Oh, that this is when Reno's a smaller town. So
yeah,
you
yeah,
had
yeah.
more opportunity to kind of yeah.
Yeah, and there, you know, it's like rich versus poor, and,
right.
and so I had always stuff always stuck with me. And my mom worked with a lot of guys that her boss hired guys off of Truckee River.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to rehabilitate guys, and so my mom would work with guys that. That were had alcohol problems or like were bums, and then they'd get their act back together, work for like 3 or 4 years, and then they fall off the wagon. And so she was like, "Man, you're only, you know," she just instilled into us like, "You're only like, you know, three to five bad moves away from living in your car,
right?
So don't mess it up." And I mean, you hear that enough, and you start thinking, you're like, "Oh yeah, that's pretty true."
Well, it's interesting because you don't leave that stuff behind, but she also didn't necessarily support you as kind of like an artist. So, I mean, things and then other things you didn't get and you found them other places, but yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like anything, you know, it was a tricky relationship, but, right. But she's cool. Pretty cool.
She's like, still around.
No.
Sorry.
No, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you learn a lot. I learned a lot from her. She was cool in a lot of ways. She you know, she's an artist. She's mm-hmm. not into the arts. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess, have you ever met any of these people, Shane McGowan, or like any, like, because you're playing over there next month. You ever met any of kind of your musical kind of?
You know, luckily I've met some of them. You know, I was doing a reading in London,
uh-huh.
and at this bar called the Boogaloo. I think it was called the Boogaloo, and that's Shane McGowan's drinking bar.
Oh, interesting.
And he was there.
Oh, darn. Okay.
And so I had my wife was there with me. Uh-huh. And
is this recently or how long?
Oh, man, 2006. I think it was okay. Motel Life.
Okay.
And I was really nervous. And then
he was there for you, though.
No, man. He was just drinking there.
He was just there drinking. Okay.
No, man. He didn't know who I was.
What?
And so I had her. I go, oh, my God, I can't do this, because he's known to be kind of – he can be mean.
He's prickly.
Prickly, yes, is a good word.
Yes.
So I said, look, you got to stand next to him. And if he says any bad thing about me, can you just tell him to shut up or, like, make him stop? Because I don't think I could handle Shane McGowan cutting me down. I think it would really, like, wreck me in a serious way.
Uh-huh.
And
because so you're doing a reading at this thing, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'm reading, playing songs.
Oh, so you're doing both, and he's just there drinking. Okay.
He's drinking. And then – And so she stands next to him, ready to, like, shut him down. And, you know, and he's like a drunk old man.
No, he doesn't look that amazing.
Yeah, he's not going to be that intimidating. She could probably punch him. And,
yeah.
But I didn't think I could recover. You know, that'd hurt, too, because he was my guy. And so anyway, she said that during I was playing, he stood up, actually, and he said, this guy's the real deal.
Oh, God, that's really, because he didn't know you. Sometimes people, when they know you, they say something like, you're great, and then they just...
No, he didn't know me.
That's great.
And then afterwards, he came over while I was signing books, and he fake stole one. Like, he took one, and he put it in his pocket, and I go, yeah, just take it. And then he kissed my hand.
Gosh, so that's a kiss. Okay, go on. Yeah.
No, yeah, so he kissed my hand. I met him, and he had really... Yeah, we shook hands, too, and And that night, you know, we went back to this hotel, and I'd never stayed in a nice hotel, really.
Uh-huh.
But the publisher at that time, they put everybody up in these kind of nice places. So I'm staying in a nice hotel, and my whole right hand was on fire because Shane McGowan had kissed my hand, and I couldn't sleep. I just walked around the town, and it was like my hand was on fire, like Shane McGowan kissed my hand.
Right.
It was like one of the greatest nights of my life, I think. So I got to meet him.
Well, because that's good to hear, too, because sometimes you meet the people who you idolize and they end up, I mean, a lot of times they disappoint you, right? I mean, that's an amazing story, I guess, because it was somebody that you really looked up to and they were really cool.
Yeah.
And I love to hear that because sometimes I've experienced, I think a lot of people, you meet your idols and then they're kind of pricks. And then
you
got to
be careful.
Like, yeah. So yeah, that's rad.
Yeah, I've been disappointed that way. Right. I usually, like, if I think they're going to be, like you said, prickly, I stay away.
Right, because it's smarter, because then you can hold that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I met and have kind of become friends with John Doe of X.
Oh, okay.
And he was another guy that was a huge influence. I dressed like him in high school and always tried to write lyrics like him and Xene.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met him and become friends with him. And he's one of those guys that's like the biggest inspiration. Once you meet him, he's even cooler.
Because
he's really into books and movies and he has like the hardest work ethic, and mm-hmm. he's always interested in new tunes and what people are working on. And he's one of the cooler guys I think I've ever met. And he's been at this racket for, you know, for as long as I've, you know, geez, 40 years or something. So yeah, you meet those guys like John Doe, that just, you leave more inspired.
Which is great. Yeah. I mean, is he still in LA?
I think he lives in Texas now.
Oh, okay. But the X is known as an LA band.
Yeah, of course. And they're still playing. They're coming up next month.
I saw that.
I'm curious. Was your mom around when the success started rolling in for you?
She just wasn't a fan of the stuff. I don't think it was. I think she was happy for me.
Mm-hmm.
But she just wasn't. I mean, it wasn't her bag. She wouldn't read my books. she just wasn't her, it wasn't what she wanted for me kind of thing. So,
well, even when it was working out, she still was kind of sour.
Yeah, even when like the ladies at the grocery store would say, his book's good. And wow. She'd just be like, yeah.
And can I ask about, was your relationship with your dad, did you guys ever talk much?
He was a cool guy. Yeah. I mean, he was a real open-minded guy. He was more of a lefty. Mm-hmm. And he was a big music fan, good boozer, like a really fun guy to drink with. But I just never lived with him, you know. So yeah. I just didn't have a lot of, we weren't that intimate, you know.
Right.
But he was a, you know, like if you met him on the street, you'd think he was a cool guy, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I liked him because he was a lefty and he liked music. He was open-minded. He was a smart guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your brother do now? What's
he's does business. He's a businessman out in L.A. He's a cool guy.
So then both you and your brother kind of went different ways. I mean,
my brother was always a lot more successful. My brother's always really always done well. He's a super smart, cool, really cool guy, and he's really open-minded too. He's like a real empathetic. Right. Really hard talk, but he's like one of the hardest working guys I've ever met, and he's
in a business. You're both hard working, but he's a businessman.
He's more of a businessman.
I mean, yeah.
And but he's cool. He's always been really nice to me.
Are you still somewhat close?
Yeah, man. I talk to him all the time. He's a great friend of mine, and always been super cool to me. And we talk all the time.
Yeah. I guess the last thing, so you have this album, The Imperial, coming out next month by the DeLonge.
It comes out in January.
Oh, next, okay, January,
yeah.
Sorry.
No, man.
How did the DeLonge name, where's that come from?
Oh, man, you might be the only one that thinks this is interesting, but for maybe 15 years, I had reoccurring dreams that I was in a part of Reno that didn't exist.
Okay.
So, like, if you were walking down Virginia Street, downtown Reno,
mm-hmm.
if you went to to the right of that, if you're like go like to the right of the downtown, there was a part of town that doesn't exist that did in my dreams. And so I'd be going down these roads that had like these old school like 1920s, 30s casinos. And for a guy that has as dark a mind as myself, my dreams are always easy. And so I'd go to this probably three times a week. I'd go to this part of Reno that didn't exist, and I'd go into these old school casinos where everybody was really nice to me, and everybody's partying. And it's like you'd go into these little like romantic kind of 1920s side bars and casinos, and just it was always fun. Never went sideways for me. And then when the lines were just starting practicing, and we had like a list of like 50 names, I had a dream one night that we were all playing this one of those casinos, and we're all in black suits, and on the drum it said the DeLonge.
Huh.
So I woke up and wrote it down, and
that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I don't know, and it's true, and so that's how the name came. It was a hard sell. But you know,
they didn't like it.
Yeah, it's like most things I do, you know, everybody's unsure about it, and then but no one comes up with anything better, and so they stick with it.
Do you have recurring dreams normally, or was that like a big anomaly?
I mean, no, I did that Reno dreams for 15 years. Yeah.
Gosh, that's wild.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
So I mean, a lot part of you is still kind of there. I mean,
oh yeah, you know. In 2008, in the crash of 2008, I tried to buy a place in Reno.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the price is really cheap.
Well, where in Reno?
You know where DeGrenay was?
Yeah, I do.
Right in that area.
Right, okay.
And
that's right off California, right?
Yeah. And
that's a great area. I mean, I lived right around there, but
I always wanted to live there. My whole life, I wanted to live there. And the sale went through. I didn't quite have enough money. And then it became like it's like hanging out with your ex-girlfriend all the time, Reno became, where it messed my head. I always wanted to move back for years and years. It was like my safety net, mm-hmm. like when my life would go fall apart, I'd dream about Reno. And it got to the point where I was going down there so much, and it was messing up my life up here.
Oh, really?
So I was just like, it's like hanging out with your ex-girlfriend. Well, when you're married, you know, it's like, sure. Man, it's not the best idea.
It's problematic.
Got problematic. Mm. So I just kind of quit going as right. much. So I quit. And I don't have any family. I got my mom's boyfriend lives there. And I got old friends there. But so I kind of quit. I've quit going so much, and it's been good for me not to. But I always loved it. Yeah, yeah,
right.
I always loved it. Yeah.
But it's still, even if you don't go there physically right now, it's, you're still dreaming about, I mean, it's still kind of part of you. Like,
yeah,
I,
yeah, man. Yeah. I always liked, there was an aspect of it. Like I said, it's not the city itself in entirety. It's a skewed little version of it,
right,
that I like.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did love that. I did love that side of it, and I do dream about it. And I used to, you know, I spent years going to Winnemuck and Elko,
mm-hmm,
and I would spend a, you know, just this last year I spent a week in Elko, just in a motel, writing and just.
Oh, really? So
you know,
you do like your
thing,
own like kind of writing fellowship things, like,
yes,
just in motels in Elko.
Yeah, and I used to do that in Reno. I used to go down and spend a week at the Fitzgerald,
uh-huh, yeah,
and
yeah,
then I would. Stay there from Sunday to Thursday,
right,
because it was
20, super cheap. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
22
rooms,
bucks.
Yeah.
And then Friday and Saturday, when they jack it to like 130, I would go stay with a buddy, and then I'd go back. And I did that for years.
Right.
Where I'd just stay there on and off until I got so, you know, until you get so weird and isolated,
yeah,
that you start falling apart, then I'd go home.
But you wrote songs and some of your books there just to like kind of get the feeling of things?
It's just fun to,
yeah, yeah,
to not have the distractions of normal life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wrote a lot of the crazy stories in the motel life in the Fitzgerald.
Hmm.
And then, but, you know, the isolation of that after a while, like just hanging out by yourself, you know, even though I had friends and stuff, I would never hang out with them. I would just I just stay in the hotel and write and then walk around all night hanging in weird places, and then I'd, you know, ride all day, and,
yeah,
and, you know, after a while, you start going nuts doing that. I used to do that at the Gold Dust West.
Right.
They still do have a cool little motel behind it, and I used to stay there all the time for years and years.
So you, I hate Reno 911.
Oh, yeah.
I hate that show.
I just love that, guys. The only thing I don't like about that show is that they don't...
It was filmed in L.A. on a soundstage.
Exactly.
That gave Reno a bad name for a number of years. And I lived here. I lived in Nebraska for a while. And that's all people knew. And I just reviled that. And I was like, that's not Reno at all. Like,
see, I didn't mind it, except I wish they would have shot it in Reno.
Bro,
you know, if they
would
have shot...
Better,
I mean, the guy in the short shorts, I just love him. And then that super hot blonde.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny, but, you know, if you're going to have a show named Reno 911,
right, it wasn't filmed in Reno.
Shoot in Reno.
Right.
It drives
and
me crazy,
then,
that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Did you see that show?
No.
I lived in Nebraska when it was like a big hit, and mm-hmm, that's what people would know Reno from, and it was just the pits, because I was like, that's not Reno. I mean, that's just, that was film. Well, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, Reno's tough because, you know, I got a lot of criticism because I portray one side of Reno.
Right. Oh, like you've gotten some pushback because.
Oh, yeah, like from old ladies and stuff. That you know, I had one old lady come up to me and say, why don't you write about you and our football team?
Oh, really?
And then I had another person that said, you know, like, Reno's not like that. And I said, well, parts of it are.
That's,
and she,
true,
goes, no. And I go, well, when's the last time you've been downtown? And she's like, oh, I won't go down there.
Oh,
and
really?
You're like, geez.
This is after Motel Life came out?
Yeah. But
okay,
they said the same thing, like, Lean on Pete, this lady came up to me and she says, horse racing's not like that. And I said, really? And she goes, yeah, you know, some of my family own horses in Kentucky, and it's not like that. And I go, well, have you ever been to Portland Meadows? And she goes, Portland Meadows? And I go, the horse track? And she goes, we have a horse track here?
Oh,
like,
well,
so a lot of people,
yeah,
a lot of people criticize, but they don't, you know, that's the interesting thing about humans. I think you can drive by rough sections of town or down and out people, and some people don't see it.
Right.
Some people see it. Some people avoid it and act like it's not there. Everybody's different that way. I always thought that was really interesting that the lady would say horse racing is not like that, and she doesn't know anything about horse racing, or the lady that says Reno's not as down and out as I made it, but she's scared to go down,
right,
to where she knows it is down and out.
Sure. Well, it's having willful blinders,
yeah,
you know, so you can sleep at night or whatever. Yeah,
it's crazy, man. But I mean, that's I think people have always been like that, and it's baffling to me. But,
mm-hmm,
but
do you? I guess this is kind of. Do you ride horses yourself? Do you own horses?
I have three horses.
Oh, damn.
Yeah,
okay.
I have an old Portland Meadows quarter horse, He was a meritable dash. He wasn't that fast. He's kind of my guy. And then we have two others, Jasper and Hugo. Yeah, so I have three horses. I'm not that good at it. My lady, she's the real cowgirl. I mean, she's a real horse person. But me, I like them, and I like hanging out with her, and I like having an old race horse.
Right.
You know, I love gambling on horses, and I got into that in Reno.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I was a big gamble. When I first moved up to Portland, I was so homesick. I didn't know what to do, and I didn't like it here. It was too big a city, and I worked at a trucking company, Graveyard, and I was in a bad situation. I was living out by 205, and my dream of just being in a band and living with happy-go-lucky, you know, depressed musicians was I was working too much, and I wasn't living that life. But so I kept wanting to move home, mm-hmm. and so I started going to the track, Portland Meadows, because it reminded me of Reno.
Were you riding horses at that point?
No, hell no, man. Oh. I romanticized it.
Yeah, okay.
I romanticized it. I love gambling on them. Sure. I love being around degenerate gamblers. I always have, and it's really fun. And so I, you know, for maybe 15 years until I rode Lean on Pete, I was out at Portland Meadows 3-4 days a week.
Oh,
I rode
a lot.
I rode novels out there.
Gosh.
And then I just started falling in love with horses and jockeys. You know, there was a really cute jockey named Twyla Beckner, and I was had a crush on her, and I'd get crushes on horses, and then I started researching these horses, and you know, because all of a sudden they wouldn't be at the track anymore, and you'd go, where's that horse I'm in love with, you know?
And so you were there so often that you knew, I mean, he was there and he wasn't. Because sometimes you go like once a month or once every 3 months.
No, man, I was there three, four days a week, and I rode a lot out there.
Right.
I rode a couple novels because it's such a nice place to write because there's huge tables. No one ever went.
Mm-hmm.
You could plug your computer in there.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it laptop or paper? It was a
laptop. Yeah, laptop, and you just hang out there all day long. And when you get tired, you just bet a race. And so I loved it, and then I just too thin-skinned, you know. I fell in love with, like I said, jockeys and horses, and you start realizing jockeys don't get paid anything, and they're really living hand to mouth, and they get hurt all the time, and then horses mean nothing. The horses were just they don't mean anything, especially at that level, and they're disposable, and then here I am hungover, eating donuts and betting on these poor horses that. Mm-hmm. that are bred for speed only, and they're not going to be great pleasure horses. They weren't raised to be normal horses. They're raised to run fast. And then you have jockeys that people don't care about, that they get hurt all the time. And so I started riding Lean on Pete. It was me breaking up with horse racing.
Huh.
Yeah, because I was having such a struggle with, just personally, with my favorite thing to do, which was betting horses, and being at the track was my favorite thing to do. And I figured no matter what in my life, if I'm a lonely old man, if I'm a destitute bum, I'll just hang out the track and I'll have friends and everything will be all right. I'll milk the rest of my life, okay? And then I started realizing, like, no, man, you can't hang out the track because they're mean to horses.
Right.
It's not a good way to spend your time betting on horses that mean nothing to anybody and that the gamblers get mad at if they break their leg. You get mad at the horse for breaking its leg and ruining your bet. I didn't want to be a part of that.
Sure.
So I quit going to the track. I rented a little kind of Sam Spade office where I started writing my stories and rode Lean on Pete to try to figure out how to break up with the thing that I spent all my, you know, all my free time. I went to the track. It was all I thought about was the track. And so, that Lean on Pete's just me breaking up with it.
And when did you buy your first horse? Or when did you buy?
You know, I think we had him 2008.
So relatively recently. And then,
yeah. And I, you know, Lean on Pete's based on my horse.
Right.
His looks and everything are on my horse. And my horse was never very fast either. Like Pete wasn't that fast. But yeah, we bought him. We had another horse at the time, and I've always loved horses, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a great horseman. I just like them.
Sure,
I like hanging out with them.
I've never been on a horse.
I was on a horse once, and it was a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, most people say that, you know, you know, I mean, it's a way of life, I think. If you want to be good at horses, I think it's definitely a commitment, I think, to be good at it.
Yeah, well, and they're so sensitive. If you're not comfortable and confident, they feel it, right, and they don't want you on them, was my experience.
Well, they get worried.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, they get worried if you are insecure. Mm-hmm. They're looking for – they're an alpha society, and so they look to the person above them to tell them it's okay, mm-hmm, and they have to believe in you. it's tough. I mean, they can give you a lot, and they can trust you. I mean, they let you get on their back.
Yeah.
I mean, you put a dead animal, a saddle, on their back, and then you get on their back, which is probably their greatest fear of all time, to have something on their back. Because when you think of bobcats or mountain lions, I mean, that's wolves. That's probably their biggest fear, and they let you do that. And they let you, and they'll take you up a hill. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll take you across a river. And they're pretty amazing, but you can get in a lot of trouble with them too. And that's, you know, like my lady, she's really good. But me, I don't, you know, I'm not confident enough in myself to take a lot of risks on a horse, just because I'm not that good at it. I'm more of a sidekick.
You must be really comfortable riding your horse now, though.
I'm all right with it, but you know, I won't take big risks. You know
what? So this is just my ignorance. What is a big risk, like going down treacherous trails,
or just riding in places that might be tricky? You know, like where we live out by a lot of logging areas. So you might come across mountain bikers or guys on hunting, mm-hmm, weirdos. You know, there's some weirdos out there.
Yeah.
So you come across that, and if you're not good on your horse, you can get in a lot of trouble. Deer, like you might come across a herd of elk, and you got to be good enough to handle all that stuff. Some days I don't know. It's a horsemanship. I think it is a way of life. The people that are really good at it, they take it seriously, because I mean, it can't kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember so my one experience on a horse was, there was a girl that I had a crush on in college, and she lived out in the country, and she had two horses, and she's like, well, come ride horses with me. And I knew it was sort of a test that I would fail. But she helped me out. She's like, here's a carrot or an apple or something. Give that to the horse so they like you a little bit. And I did. But as soon as I got on the horse, he started running. And he started running towards a low tree to knock me off. And so all I could do is sort of slide to the side. And then I was riding on the side of his belly for I don't know how long until he stopped.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I will say is, like, going out with a horse chick it's like going out with a musician. You either accept it and you embrace it, or you get off. Because the love, you know, my mom went out with a cowboy once, and he told me, he took me aside, and I don't even remember this guy's name. He wasn't around that long. And she said, he goes, look, man, whatever you do, don't go out with a woman that likes horses. Because she'd throw you in front of a bus to save her horse. And he goes, and if you want to buy a horse, don't do it, man. And he had a bunch of horses. He goes, just buy a motorcycle, ride it around and act like it's a horse. And then you put it in the garage, leave it there for a year, and then you put a little gas in it, and you're on your horse again until you get bored with it, and you put it back in the garage.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, and I never listen. You know, I should listen to him, because all you do is fix stuff and clean up manure, man. I mean, you know, and feed them.
But it sounds like it worked out for you. You're with the horse lady.
Yeah, horse ladies are the best, man. Yeah. You just got to embrace it. It's like going out with a musician. Same thing. You can't fight them. Once they're musicians, you're just like, all right, do I want to be with a musician? That's the question. But you can't force a musician out of a musician.
Yeah.
You can't force a horse lady not to love her horses, you know. So, yeah, I've always, like I said, I romanticize, man. I like being around them, you know. I like being a sidekick. When she goes, she does clinics and stuff and goes around. And I always like being around. I like being around them, but I'm juggling enough things badly that I probably will never be a great horseman.
Mm-hmm. So let's just end with, so the Imperial, this comes out probably the same time that this show will come out. So what's going on with this?
So the Lines, we did a record in 2014 called Colfax. And then we took a break because Richmond Fontaine was doing a tour. And while we were touring, Amy Boone, the singer, got hit by a car.
Oh, yeah. So I read about it. Okay.
And she broke both her legs. Gosh. Really rough. Really rough on her. You know, 8 major surgeries.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Does she have insurance?
No.
Oh, my God.
But she got hit. She was walking on a sidewalk in a parking lot. And a lady was driving with a cast on her foot and got it caught and ran her into a lava rock wall. Mm. It's pretty brutal. So she spent over 2 years just trying to get her health back. Luckily, we had recorded a lot of what's on the Imperial before she got hurt. And we just waited, and she's so tough, and she's got her health back, and she can walk, and she's doing good, and she just moved up here. She's from Austin, Texas, and she moved up here to start rehearsing, and we finished the record. And we'll start touring again. I hope people like it. It's a really fun band to be in. It's always been my dream to be in a band with a good singer, and where I can just hide in the back and write tunes. And
she has a great voice. Yeah.
I think so. With her, I always believe everything she sings, and she has a kind of voice I've always admired. And she was in a band called the Damnations with her sister, a really successful kind of cowpunky band, and we toured with them a little bit, and that's how I met her and her sister. Her sister sang on a couple of Richmond Fontaine songs,
mm-hmm.
And then she did a tour with us in Fontaine once, and as a member, and I used to hear her warm up before the gig. Me and another guy in Fontaine would kind of eavesdrop on her, mm-hmm. just practicing, and we were both like, oh my God, I would love to be in a band where she sang, and I was like, me too. And so I basically just went home and wrote her a record, and then tried to convince her to join up. She just showed me the letter I sent her.
So you wrote Colfax with her in mind, but
yes.
She wasn't. Oh, okay.
But she didn't know that.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's okay. I didn't realize that.
Well, yeah. I wanted to make sure I had the pieces in place to convince her to do it. I was scared she would say no. You know, she'd had other things going on, and I was scared that she wouldn't want to be in a band with me. And so I spent a good year just writing tune after tune four, and then thinking about the sound of it and all that.
Uh-huh.
And then she was nice enough to give it a shot. I was just like, just try it. It won't be that painful.
Right.
And so she came up, and luckily, you know, we'd only been a band for a week when we recorded the record. But the players are so good in that band. I'm by far the worst musician in that band. And then Colfax did okay, and we toured a lot. And
great.
And then hopefully we'll start touring again, depending on how she feels and how people like the record. You know, we'll keep touring and playing. Hopefully, make a bunch of records.
But you're going to the UK and Ireland in January and February, right?
Yeah.
Or to tour the Imperial.
Yeah, that's
okay,
true.
So you got some stuff already, like yeah.
Yeah, and then we're going back in April, late April, May, to mainland. Europe.
Okay. So you're there for awesome.
Yeah, Fontaine always did better in Europe, so we're playing a lot of the same markets.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice. Sonny?
Thank you so much for coming.
Reno Pride. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's always nice to talk to somebody from Reno.
Yes, it is. And Reno's the best, too.
Yeah, I always think, like, if you could go back in time.
Yeah.
Like, where would you, like, if I could go back in time, there was a time they say that there's two times. There was a time when Carol Lombard was in Reno.
Okay.
And she's an old famous actress.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could go back in time when Carol Lombard was there and go out with Carol Lombard, I would. And then there was a time when Bobby Gentry was married to Bill Hara. Bobby Gentry's a famous country singer. She wrote Ode to Billy Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And she's beautiful and a really good songwriter. And if I could have met her, you know, when she was living in Reno with Bill Hara.
Which is like the 40s, or when was this?
Oh, 60s.
Oh, so this is more recent. Okay.
So that's the other thing. If I could go back then and maybe go out with Bobby Gentry.
Yes.
And then and then we could just live at one of Bill Hara's, you know, ranches.
Right.
I think I could do that. So I'm working on how to get back in time.
God. I'm sure your wife loves this plan.
Yeah, she's put up with it. You know, like in my office, I have my favorite ladies. Yeah. I got Myrna Loy, the actress. You ever seen The Thin Man? Mm-hmm. Myrna Loy.
I don't know if I've seen The Thin Man, but I know Myrna Loy.
The Thin Man, Myrna Loy is an heiress. So she's just bleeding money. She's the most beautiful woman of all time, and she's really funny and really sharp and tough, but like really smart, but also just like will wake her husband up in the middle of the night and make him a cocktail. So I'm like, so she's my editor. She's like my main gal. Yeah. And then Carol Lombard, same thing, really tough, really smart woman, but funny, like a slapstick comedian. And so those are my two ladies that I stare at. And my wife, she puts up with
it. And your wife, yeah, yeah.
Well, she puts up with those ladies. Yeah.
I love that you mentioned Myrna, because that's who I named the lead character in a detective series I'm working on after. Really? Myrna, yeah.
Yeah, Myrna Loy is the best.
It's a great name.
There's a great songwriter named Scott McCoy. He's in a band called The Minus Five. Mm-hmm. He's a genius, but he wrote a song about Myrna Loy. To me, he was in the Young Fresh Fellows. He's probably one of the great unsung.
I know The Minus Five.
Songwriters of ever. Anyway, he wrote a song about Myrna, and then I wrote him a song about Myrna, where the Minus Five are playing while Myrna and I are making out. But we have talks about Myrna all the time, man. We're both obsessed with Myrna.
And, you and Scott McCoy and your wife.
And she's she was a lefty, she's from Montana. Okay. So God, how could you? I mean, she's a Montana girl who's, you know, pro workers' rights and a lefty, and she's good looking. And in a certain way, she probably wasn't a rich heiress. Mm-hmm. Jesus, that just sounds so nice. Yeah. And she makes good cocktails, at least in The Thin Man she did.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah, can you imagine your gal, just like if you woke up in the middle of the night and you're like, I sure would like a chin fizz. And your gal gets out. And your gal's Myrna Loy, and she's in like some kind of silk, you know, robe.
Right.
And she comes back with a gin fizz and just makes you laugh for the rest of the night. Jesus.
That's the life.
That's the life I want, man.
That's the life I think we all want. All right.
All right. Thank you so much, Willie. This has been great. You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.